right, decisions. Every one of us got a whole lot of decisions to be making in these days, and you better make good ones, because I think the entire world is counting on us, all right? Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, as usual, they have a reserved seat for me. Actually, Teddy put a sign up on the chair, and I'm a little worried because it seems the chair is a little shaky and might turn over, but, you know, what the hell? We'll see. Anyway, we have a packed show today, so I'll stop messing around.
At the back end of the show, we'll hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a radical revolt against a revolting culture. Now, this is an excerpt from the DVD BA Speaks Revolution Nothing Less, and this is featured on a new feature page at revcom.us, and the name of that page is A Righteous Upsurge Against Sexual Assault, A Crucial Step Toward a Different World. Definitely check this one out.
Before that, we'll be talking with artist Dred Scott, and he's joining us to talk about his latest work that is due to premiere sometime in the next year. It's the Slave Rebellion reenactment, and it's a community-based performance that will restage and reinterpret Louisiana's revolt of 1811. It was the largest slave revolt in the history of this country, all right? And it is going to be a trip, all right? Now, opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Corinne McSherry. She's the legal director of Electronic Frontier Foundation, and she's joining us to talk about the latest developments with the Trump administration's threats to net neutrality. Corinne, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Sure. Okay, Corinne, pull us out of this mess. Tell us what's going on. You recently described that the recently revealed plans of the FCC, you described them as plans to devastate network neutrality. First, for those of us who don't know what these plans are and why they're so catastrophic, tell us.
Sure. So net neutrality is sort of an unfortunate name for what is really about protecting freedom of expression online. Basically, net neutrality is a set of rules that make sure that the internet service providers that we rely on for internet access, people like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, basically play fair and don't get to sort of pick winners and losers online, because they're in a position, right, where they're our conduit to the internet. That's how you get to the internet. That's how you access Netflix, but it's also how you access government websites, libraries, school, education, right? We all rely on the internet for all kinds of basic services and also to organize politically, connect to communities. And that's fantastic. And the internet can be a wonderful place for that. But to get to it, we have to rely on these internet service providers, which usually in most markets are monopolies. You don't have a choice. So up until 2 days ago, we had a set of rules in place that were enforced by the FCC that prohibited those ISPs from, for example, favoring one website over another, making it so that if you're a user trying to access a website, one of them goes really nice and fast and the other one is kind of slow and clunky. The ISPs can do that. They can prioritize certain services. And we had rules in place to say, no, you can't do that. That's unfair. You would be abusing your monopoly power if you did that. What the FCC is proposing to do is to scrap all of those rules, just get rid of them. And, you know, these rules have been in place since the birth of the internet, basically. It's been an understanding that this is what you had to do. The FCC says, no, we don't think you need to comply with any of these rules and obligations, and just, you know, go ahead, do what you want.
Well, there was the 2015 Open Internet Order. From what I've read, and believe me, I'm somebody who just, like, you know, I get on the computer and I say, Internet, oh, you know, it's there. And I just use it and do it. And I don't think about all the things behind it, including the various political struggles behind it. So it's kind of, and I think there's probably a lot of people like me who just sort of like, ooh, we can have fun on this, you know, or use it to whatever way we want to use it. And it'll always be there in a certain sense. It was discovered, it was developed, and it's there. And the idea of actually it being private property is something that I think people haven't really thought about a whole lot. And so I wanted to talk to you about that. When did it actually become private property? And what really, deep down and dirty, what does it being private property mean?
So the internet has always pretty much been private property in the sense that service providers, telecom companies, have built the infrastructure and they invested in it. And in exchange for that, they expected to get paid back. And that's not necessarily a problem. But for a long time, with most forms of internet in the early days, there were rules in place that basically said, okay, this is private property, but you have to let everybody play on it. Just because you built the infrastructure doesn't mean you get to control who gets to use that infrastructure. And then something changed about 10 years ago when they started building up high-speed internet access, which is great. It's called broadband, and now everybody has it, and, you know, that's as opposed to dial-up. I don't know if you remember dial-up, but in the olden days, you used your phone lines to access the internet. Mm-hmm. Now you use broadband, and so that's private property, too. But what the companies that built that particular infrastructure have tried to argue from the beginning is that this is different, and all those rules that applied to telephone lines shouldn't have to apply to us. That's new. And what's interesting is that the FCC actually, for that entire time, has been saying in various ways, no, actually, some version of those rules do apply. But what they were doing is they were doing it on the wrong legal basis. And we don't need to get too wonky, but that's what happened in 2015. Millions of internet users spoke out and told the FCC, we want these rules that you're trying to put in place, but you need to do it in a way that's actually going to be upheld by the courts. And so they finally did. So that was an enormous win for internet users of all kinds. And that's what the FCC is trying to reverse.
Mm-hmm. Now, under this new proposal that they're trying to get in, they say that the federal government will stop micromanaging the internet and instead simply require internet service providers to be transparent about their practices. And anybody just reading it, just not knowing much more than I do about the internet, might say, well, what the hell does that mean? And then say, well, it sounds fair and good, too. I mean, you know, they're going to say that this federal government has to stop micromanaging the internet, and we don't want the government's hands in things.
Right. Well, first of all, the FCC wasn't micromanaging anything. to some extent, they maybe could have done a little more management, would have been good. This is really just rhetoric, because what they're saying is that the FCC was micromanaging the internet. It wasn't doing any such thing. What the FCC did is put in place rules for the ISPs, the monopoly ISPs, right, to basically act fairly in allowing us to access the internet and also allowing websites and services to get access to us as users. And the idea that transparency is going to be enough is, I think, nonsense. So, because what they're trying to say is, well, they'll just be really open about their practices. And then if they're deceptive, then we'll come after them for being deceptive. Well, what the ISP is going to do is say, I'm completely open about the fact that I am favoring my service over somebody else. I'm completely honest about it. So too bad. There's nothing you can do about it, because as me as a consumer, right, I don't have a choice. I can't go choose a different ISP. We wouldn't need these rules if we had competition, or be less likely to need them. But since I as a user don't have a choice, you know, when you have a monopoly situation, that is one of the few times when it's a good idea for the government to get involved. And that's what we have here.
Mm-hmm. Just so I can be clear. So basically, yeah. If you're sitting there and you could actually be just like, okay, you have a certain internet provider and you're sitting at home and you're wherever and you're working on it, and all of a sudden it's a much slower speed somehow and you didn't do anything, or you don't think you touched anything wrong, or you didn't pay the bill, or it's going much slower, or you don't have access to as many things. That's actually what could happen, is they could actually control it to that degree?
Well, think of it this way. This is just a super simple example, but let's say there's Netflix and then there's a rival movie streaming service. Mm-hmm. I, as a consumer, I could access either one. Let's say I've subscribed to either one, but suddenly, like, Netflix is really clunky and slow, whereas Comcast's service is really nice and fast. Well, I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, I'm going to choose this other service because it seems really fast. It's not going to occur to me that Comcast is actually shaping that, right? Comcast is making a choice to make one slow and one not slow. Or similarly, you might say, okay, well, Netflix will pay that extra toll to get into the fast lane so that I as a user will experience Netflix as great. But every time I try to log on to my local library, a government site, hospital sites, and so on, basic service sites, they're really clunky and slow. And maybe I start thinking, like, why does the government have such terrible internet? Well, it's not the government that has terrible internet. It's that the ISP has chosen to make that internet terrible. Mm-hmm. But I won't know the difference, right? I won't realize that as a user, that actually the ISP is manipulating my access to basic websites and services.
Now, a couple more questions. One is censorship. And actually, is it really true that they could actually block access to a number of websites and things like that, things that they don't want to have people go to, that they just, you know, for whatever reason, including, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about a lot of the most progressive websites that are out on the internet now, and a lot of people go to them and learn things mm-hmm. about them. Is that actually a possibility of them actually censoring that, stopping people's access to this?
It is absolutely a possibility. And the reason I know that is because they've already done it. Right, and they've been caught many times, and so therefore they, you know, and they've been held accountable because we had rules in place. We don't have those rules anymore. If this order goes through, we don't have those rules. I mean, we've seen this. A Canadian ISP blocked access to a site that provided information about abortion. That was absolutely a political choice. And when it was caught, there was a big uproar around it, and that's great. But, you know, they won't always get caught, right? And they'll do it. Oh, they'll throttle it. They'll slow it down. So suddenly it's like, oh, you know, I'm not even going to bother to go to that website because it's so slow. I'm going to go to this other one over here. This is absolutely a real, not just a possibility, it's a probability.
Boy. All right, one last question for you. You know, in reading the your thoughts on it on the Electronic Frontier Foundation site, you left me with like, wow, there's a lot of hope here because there's a lot of fight. Talk to people now about what they can do, how they can stand up against this.
Right. So I'm very glad we're having this conversation right now because it is not too late. And I think the forces on the other side are trying to make it seem like this is a done deal. It is not a done deal. So what we need to do right now is not reach out to the FCC anymore. Reach out to Congress. Reach out to your Congress representative and say, tell the FCC to stop this, call a halt. Right now, we have till December 14th to call a halt at this level. And then we have some other arrows in our quiver, I assure you. So go to battleforthenet.com, where there's a call tool. And calls are the most effective ways to reach Congress right now. We need to light up and melt the phone lines.
All right. Thank you very much, Karina. Really appreciate you joining us today. And we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Corinne McSherry, the legal director of Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we've been talking about the Trump administration's threat to net neutrality, and you've heard what it's going to mean, folks. So once again, you got decisions to make. You got decisions to make, all right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Dred Scott. A little piece from John Fogerty, all right? And I'm really glad to be playing that because I thought it really had some meaning for what we're about to talk about now, all right? And basically, we've had Dred Scott on our show before. He's a renowned artist. He's an artist that really, I really like a lot. And I really, everything he does really makes you think, makes me think, and it kind of twists my head around real quick. Dred makes revolutionary art to propel history forward. His work is exhibited across the U.S. and internationally. And for three decades, he's made work that encourages viewers to re-examine unifying ideals and values of society, and especially of this American society. In 1989, and this is one of my favorite things that Dred has behind in his little sort of curriculum vitae. In 1989, the entire U.S. Senate denounced and outlawed one of his artworks, and President G.H.W. Bush declared it disgraceful because of its transgressive use of the American flag. Dred, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thank you for having me on. It's really great to be back.
Yeah. Thank you for all this time of just providing art that really makes your soul jump. All right. So that's I wanted to get into that. And I want to tell people this project you're working on now is really a very special project, and it's a slave rebellion reenactment. Why don't you tell them in detail what this means?
Well, I mean, the short answer is in the title. It is a slave rebellion reenactment. And a lot of people say, what? You know, and I said, yeah, we're going to reenact the largest rebellion of enslaved people in North American history. That rebellion is pretty much, you know, been suppressed. A lot of people don't know about it. If you know something about American history, you might know about Nat Turner or Gabriel Prosser or Denmark Vesey. But this rebellion happened in 1811 outside of New Orleans. And the thing that's really amazing about it is it had a chance of succeeding, and succeeding wouldn't have been just getting revenge by killing some white people before they got killed or escaping and setting up a maroon colony. They wanted to seize all of Orleans territory, which was basically the size of modern-day Louisiana, and end slavery. the slave army got up to about 500 people. And so I want to bring that history to life in a way that will, you know, be a profound, sort of exciting and wonderful, inspiring vision for some people and a challenge for some other people, to have 500 sort of, you know, descendants of enslaved Africans, you know, black people that will be marching with muskets and machetes and cane knives and sickles and sabers and horses and flags flying in the locations that was sugar plantations and is now oil refineries and trailer parks and big box stores and strip malls and gated communities. It'll be, you know, just exhilarating for a lot of people to see that come, you know, marching towards New Orleans, saying, on to New Orleans, freedom or death, we're going to end slavery.
And having read some of this myself, I was really intrigued and really glad to see that you took this up. You know, it's sort of, it's interesting because when people think about this particular rebellion, it's more than just, it was the largest, but there's more to the story than that. It was much more that's unknown to people generally. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, part of why it's unknown is, you know, I mean, it's complicated, but the short answer is it was spun from day one. Louisiana wasn't a state yet. This happened in 1811. Louisiana didn't become a state until 1812. And the governor at the time, I mean, it was largely a French colony, but it was owned by the United States, so there was a U.S. governor. And since they were applying for statehood after they put down the rebellion, they basically said, look, there's nothing to see here. Go move along. Because if you're having slave revolts in your future state, it makes statehood application a little bit difficult. So they just, you know, said there's not much to see. And, you know, this is in the days before there was an internet, before there was an AP wire service. So even though news of this traveled as far away as England and, you know, was covered widely across the U.S. and Philadelphia and New York, et cetera, it was all based on stories that were reported initially in Louisiana at the time. So this got kind of lost to history. It didn't seem like it was much of anything until some sort of radical revolutionary activists who had family history with this unearthed and dug up this history and published a book about it in 1995. And so, you know, it was inspired by the Haitian Revolution. It was directly connected to the Haitian Revolution in some ways, and we can talk about that if you want. But it was this thing that would have changed U.S. and world history if it was successful. And all slave revolts were a long shot. This was a long shot to succeed. It was never likely to succeed, but it could have succeeded. And if not for some historic accident that happened at the time, it might have. And we would have been having a whole different conversation because the U.S. wouldn't be what it is today.
Well, let's talk about its links to Haiti, because the revolution that occurred in Haiti was actually one of the most radical revolutions in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, they defeated the French Admiralty, which was the most powerful navy on the planet at the time. Haiti was the main sugar producer in the world at the time. It was producing for France, and France owned both Haiti and enslaved people there, and they basically had, you know, deep connection in a colonial outpost in New Orleans, as well as other parts of the Caribbean and South and Central America. But they used New Orleans to basically be both a food producer and a sugar refiner for the sugar that's being grown in Haiti. So when the revolution happens there, the slave owners flee, and they could easily go to New Orleans because that was still a French colony, and they bring some of the people that they enslaved with them. So the people that were there had direct experience, at least inspiration, and some may have participated in the Haitian Revolution. They get to New Orleans, and at a minimum, there's news of this powerful, powerful revolution that happened, and it was actually not only the most powerful that defeated the French Navy, but it actually was, you know, really one of the main successful slave revolts, and it lasted years, but that was a really inspiring legacy. And then so people that were both had direct experience or heard word of were like, well, wait a minute, maybe we could do that in New Orleans. And so that's what happened. And one of the main leaders, a guy who was enslaved on the Vallon plantation named Charles, became a leader of the revolt in New Orleans in 1811, and he was Haitian. We don't know exactly what his links to the Haitian Revolution were, but he definitely, you know, came from Haiti and probably came, you know, with his slave owner in like 1802 or 1803 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with artist Dred Scott about his most recent work that he's developing, and he's going to unleash on the world very soon, right, Dred?
We're looking at November of next year, so it's not very soon, but it is very soon in a certain sense, because we're organizing 500 people to sort of embody this history in the Army of the Enslaved, as well as a handful of slave owners, some of whom will get killed and others of whom will be a planter's militia chasing this slave army. But it's going to be out there. But the thing is, all slave revolts obviously had to be organized clandestinely. You couldn't just like go to the town square and post up a flyer and say, yo, whoever wants to revolt, come down here. And you couldn't hit up your friends on Facebook or anything in 1811. They had to organize clandestinely. So Charles talked to a relatively small group of people, and those people in turn recruited other people in small clandestine cells. And so mirroring that structure, I'm talking with probably about 75 people, and those who, you know, agree to walk for 2 days, 26 miles, warm or cold, rain or shine, they get recruited into the Army of the Enslaved, and they both have to keep that a secret that they're part of it, but also recruit other people. And so I'm mirroring that structure of how people back in 1811, who had the most radical vision of freedom on the North American continent at the time, how they organized to defeat a system of slavery. And so we're learning from that, you know, bold vision and desire to be free, including by ending the system of slavery, not just by escaping or, you know, and getting personal freedom, but actually overturning the system that was keeping all sorts of people in bondage. So in a certain sense, the project has begun now because I am building the Army of the Enslaved even sort of right now. But the spectacle of it, the 500 people, will be of November next year, November 2018.
You know, there's a part in, I can't remember where I read this, but it was in something you were talking about. It said, you said that this thing had the most radical position of freedom on the North American continent, and it existed inside the heads of the enslaved people.
Yeah.
And that was really important. The problem is slavery and the solution to end it. It wasn't like sort of, oh, what are we going to do? They had this radical solution, and they weren't going to let go of it. And it was what motivated them, what was in their head, what led them to actually do what they did.
Yeah, no, I think that's really sort of part of why I'm trying to do this project is that, I say I make revolutionary art to propel history forward, and so a lot of that is all the work. But the thing is, right now, a lot of people are constrained by what they think is possible to change, you know, and as opposed to starting from what they think is necessary. So if you were enslaved in 1811, it would have been very difficult to get free. It would have been hard to even escape. That was very difficult to do. But to actually overturn the system of slavery would have been very, very hard. But that's what was needed, and they decided to go for that. People look at the American Constitution and they say, oh, well, that talks about freedom, or they talk about the rights of man embodied in the French society at the time. Those systems were based on enslaving people. The freedom that was embodied in the U.S. Constitution and is embodied in the U.S. Constitution is predicated upon owning other human beings. That was not a radical vision of freedom. Yet these enslaved people, who were sort of more subject to French rule than U.S. rule, they weren't saying, well, let's see if we can make the French rule a little bit more palatable. Maybe it will only get whipped Monday through Friday. And they weren't saying, well, maybe we can like get the U.S. to take over more quickly. That'll work out better for us. They said, no, the problem is that we're enslaved. The solution is to rise up and overthrow the system of slavery, that we can, you know, unite all sorts of people who are held in bondage. And they, even though it's a great risk, great personal risk, and likely to be defeated, and people will likely be killed and their families perhaps tortured, but that was actually the option that they went for. And that's a very radical stance that people, modern day people, could learn a lot from. Imagine the problems that would be approached differently if people started from what is confronting us. I talk to people sometimes about, like, you know, murder by police. That's something that outrages all sorts of people, this epidemic of, you know, 1,100 people being killed by the police every year. And a lot of times people agree and they say, well, yeah, we can get them to wear body cams. And that's all cool. I'm glad that there's more video evidence of the murderous nature of the police, but that's not stopping the police from killing people. That's what people are demanding. But they're moving away from because they think it's more easy or possible or achievable to, you know, get the police to wear body cameras rather than to stop the police from murdering people. And so with this vision of people rising up to end slavery, even though it's historic, and, you know, people can look back and say, oh, wait, this was a whole different method and an approach to freedom. And it was in the head of the enslaved. And there is something that's, I think, really important about that. People who were at the very bottom of society, who weren't thought of as like the people articulating the great freedoms and you know, constitutions that were written at the time. It was the people who were bearing the brunt and the base of the society that actually had the vision of how to get free and what the real problem with the foundation of that society was.
Yeah, you know, even the fact that, and when you, like you call it the Army of the Enslaved, even the fact that the word enslaved is used as opposed to just sort of slaves, as like, well, you're born a slave, you know, whatever, you're captured, you become a slave. This point about it's enslaved, it's not a voluntary process, it's not a natural process. People have actually been enslaved. And that's something I think that must in terms of the people that you're going out and talking to, and you think about the impact this could have broadly among Black people, but among all people, this idea that, you know, look, too long we've talked about slavery as well, the slaves, and not the enslaved people, that they didn't walk in and volunteer because the benefits were good.
Yeah, I don't think the benefits were particularly good. No, but it's really true, and I think that is an important thing, that there's been a shift in how people are starting to see slavery, and that this thing of people being enslaved is really important. I mean, when I started this project about 4 years ago, I didn't realize how deeply the question touched the souls, particularly of Black youth, because I would start going to college and university campuses and talking with people about the project. And a lot of times youth would get assigned to come to my lectures. And then afterwards they would come up and tell me, hey, you know, we didn't want to come here because we didn't want to talk about slavery. And the more I'd talk with them, they would say, well, you know, we couldn't figure out how our ancestors allowed themselves to become slaves. You know, why did they do that? And it was sort of more like, what's wrong with us? And you look around today and, you know, Black people are catching hell all over the world, but particularly in the United States, where, you know, is where I'm talking about this. And you know, you look at the housing projects, you look at the police, you look at, you know, how people are caught up in some senseless nonsense and fighting over, you know, a street corner or something. But they look at that and they think, man, we're messed up. What's wrong with us? But then when they learned that slavery was something that was done to people, people were enslaved, and that beyond that, that there were over 250 documented cases of 10 people or more organizing some sort of rebellion in the United States during its history of slavery, then they're like, wait, we want to know more about this. And it lifts a real shame from them. People were really feeling ashamed of how they are as people in the present because of how the story of slavery and enslavement has been spun. And so, you know, it really affects how people even hold their heads up right now. And so that when people see that there was resistance and fighting back and that women played an important role in that, it's a whole different conversation.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, too, that I actually thought was really important, and you started to speak to this earlier, but it's worth revisiting, the point that the territory you're covering in this reenactment, and I think it's really remarkable. I think people really need to remember how you're following this all the way through. Like you said, it's not like you're going out and organizing every single soul that's going to be part of this, but there's actually this spread, the way that rebellions of enslaved people actually had to get organized was deep down, underground, kind of figuring out the ways to get people together so that you could live to even be able to do this, to launch it to begin with. And you started to talk about that you're going to take the exact same path in this march. And I thought it was really, really interesting because you also talked about the marked difference in landscape, which you mentioned earlier about, well, it's got this, it's got, you know, housing, it's got factories, it's got whatever. But there actually is more to it than that, I think, because it's also, in a way, it shows a certain continuity between the enslaved people in the past and what's happening to people today, and often to those very same people in terms of their ancestry and everything else. But it really does, it positions it right in the middle of the most evil empire ever to exist on the face of the earth, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's like I tell people with a lot of my work that I am looking at how the past both shapes the present, conditions the present, but also how it exists in the present in new form. And that's both for the oppressors and the oppressed. And so this area that was sugar plantations is actually a hodgepodge of what is there now. But one of the things that there is, you know, oil industry. I mean, that part of that area is called Cancer Alley because it's so toxic and there's high incidence of cancer based on the oil refineries that are there. And it, quite literally, some of them put the oil refineries right on top of plantations and buried, you know, Black cemeteries and stuff like that. There are places in which the land that some of the plantations that have been preserved are on land that was deeded to them by oil companies who bought it from them back in the 1920s and 30s. And oil is, you know, one of the motors of the current economy. And so there's this very literal connection between sugar being the motor of the, you know, part of the slave economy in 1811 and oil being the motor of a modern day imperialist economy. But it's also, this is artwork. It's not just that literal, even though there is that coincidence. But there is this thing where the shadow of slavery is extremely long in America. And that region, Louisiana, has, I think, the highest per capita incarceration rate. The prison Angola, you know, which is named because people from Angola were basically enslaved on the plantation there and now become a prison, is right in that region. I mean, it's not right there, but it's, you know, within 15 miles or 20 miles of where I'm going to be. And so there is this whole history that maps on top of it. So this Army of the Enslaved is going to be kind of like a ghost army kind of walking through the present, because we will have, you know, clothing, this antiquated clothing, you know, from like French colonial clothing, and these antiquated weapons, you know, muskets and machetes and stuff like that. But it will stir up the ghosts of the past in the present. And I think that going through gated communities and trailer parks and strip malls as people that are sort of embodying sort of an army of the enslaved, that will be like, you know, for people that are walking down the streets, they'll be like, what the hell am I looking at? And that'll be a real basis for some of them to say, oh, hell yeah, if we're going to end slavery, I want to connect up with that. And other people to say, oh, no, this ain't happening. This is bad. Armed black people, this is really bad. So, you know, but it'll be this history. It's this history that's really resonant in that area, and people kind of deciding to not, you know, portray broken people who were slaves, but actually an army of enslaved people who are liberating themselves is something that I think will be really inspiring to many and challenging to others.
So let's look at this. And we're coming up towards the end of the interview, but and I'm going to have you back again, you know, as this develops, because I'm really interested in this. And at some point I'm going to, you know, say, Dredd, don't you need somebody to do radio coverage on this when it happens?
Come on down.
Yeah, I think I will. Anyway, you know, this whole idea about returning a suppressed history you've just been talking about, and it's really very heavy because, as you pointed out earlier, this is a history that could have changed this country and the world in a big way.
Yeah.
And then you look at what it has to do with today. And you've mentioned in talking about this that it creates a space for a dream of what if. And I think that's really important, you know, because people, look, there's a struggle for people to even dream or to think about in terms of what if.
Oh, that's a large part of this. So, you know, people say, well, you're enacting a slave revolt. I might not have heard of it, but, you know, there's going to be this, like, you know, since I haven't heard of it, I know the slaves lost. So you're going to just have like a bunch of white people killing a bunch of black people. And I don't need to, you know, see a reenactment to see that. I could just look at YouTube or the news or something. And it's like, well, hold up. This is not that. This is, we're interrupting the historic timeline because this rebellion was put down. And put down in truly medieval terms, people should check out this history. I mean, it's really gross and disgusting what the slave owners did to people they enslaved. But I'm interrupting that history to enable people to have a space to imagine what if. Because I think that what if is extremely important in the present. Because what if this was successful? And again, this was unlikely to succeed, but it could have succeeded. And I don't just mean that in a wishful sense, though, like I would have liked it to succeed, but they planned for about a year to do this. They had ties all up and down the river, including with Maroon colonies. They had plans to seize the fort that was one of the five forts that was a part of the gated city of New Orleans. And they had people that had military training. This was, you know, not a spontaneous one guy got whipped too much. This was a planned uprising. And then, you know, enabling people to dream, but what if about uprisings, but also what about the successful fundamental transformation that having people, like, you know, sort of successfully carry out this march and embodying this history where it isn't put down, but where it is, creates a space for people to dream of, man, maybe if that happened, then, you know, maybe Texas doesn't secede from Mexico. If Texas doesn't secede from Mexico, maybe then California doesn't. I mean, I know you're out in California. Maybe California doesn't become part of the U.S. Maybe the whole westward expansion doesn't happen. And then you have a different world, and you have capitalism on a whole different course, which, you know, wouldn't be crushing and destroying the lives the way that it did and continues to today. And so I think, you know, for people that hope for really fundamental change, this is a project for you. This is both the history is for you, but also it's a project of people who wish to dream of how the world could have been different, but also could be different, and what they can do as part of making it different. I mean, this is artwork, and it, you know, as you said earlier, it makes you think. I hope this work makes you think, even just in the name, but also people seeing it and seeing these images of modern day people, including, you know, with some, you know, might still have eyeglasses that are modern day or shoes that, so it's not trying to say, okay, this is what it was like really back in the day, but actually things giving it away a little bit to say, no, this is about the present. This is about modern day people who are sort of shaking off the shackles of oppression and standing up by embodying this history of people's ancestors, not literally at their ancestors. Although I think we will have some people who do actually have ties to that region and may have participated in the original revolt. But mostly it's about sort of a new generation, college kids, largely from historically black colleges like Xavier and Dillard, you know, in that area, but also others that, you know, want to bring this history to life for people to think about in the modern and in the present.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jed, I want to thank you very much for this, and we will stay in touch. And I want you, you know, what you just ended on is really important. And in terms of everything you've been saying, the point that you've made many times in talking about this project, you want people to think not in terms of what seems possible, but what's necessary and dream the impossible. And that's really, really important.
Yeah, and it's really important if people want to know more about this, they can go to slave-revolt.com. That's a way they could kind of connect up with it. They can be part of it, perhaps, if they live in the area or can get there. They can contribute to it financially if they want to in some ways, you know. But this is a way that they could connect up and see more about this project and learn more. I mean, you could see great costumes that are in the process of being built. And yet, you can dream of how the world could be different both now and what you can do about it in the present and see this artwork. So, yeah.
All right, Jed, thank you very much, and we will definitely have you back on this, man.
Okay, thanks so much.
Take care. Bye. Talk to you later. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dred Scott. Dred's an internationally known artist, and we've been talking about his Slave Rebellion reenactment that's coming up. He's working on now a community-based performance that will restage and reinterpret Louisiana's revolt of 1811 and will hopefully set people on a whole new trajectory, all right?
Dirty old part of the city where the sun refused to shine. People tell me it ain't no use in trying. My little girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before your time.
Welcome back. That was We Gotta Get Out of This Place by The Animals. Now, in the past few weeks, against the backdrop of the accusations against Harvey Weinstein, Roy Moore, and the bragging of sexual abuse by Trump, the predator-in-chief himself, a volcano has erupted. RevCom.us has begun a special feature, a page devoted to the upsurge against the harassment, abuse, and assaulting of women in this society, especially in workplaces, but also through every nook and cranny of society. It's going to feature news on this struggle, analysis, and commentary from Revolution Newspaper and others, and key works grounded in Babavakian's new synthesis of communism that shed light on this. The aim, to unleash the fury of women as a mighty force for revolution. So we're going to hear Resisting the Brainwash, a radical revolt against a revolting culture. It's an excerpt from a talk by Babavakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's part of the DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less.
Let's put it this way. Resisting this system's brainwash and developing a radical revolt against its revolting culture, that is a great need. You know, Marx, in talking about capitalism, spoke to the phenomenon of what he called commodity fetishism. Now, he didn't mean dirty old men doing perverse things with commodities. What he meant was that almost a religious significance is attached to the relation between things produced and exchanged as commodities, and the relations among people that underlie this are hidden and obscured. For example, you go to the store to buy something. Once again, our infamous iPhones, let's say. You take that one universal commodity that's good for exchanging with everything, money, and you give it to the store owner, who will then, if you give him the proper amount, give you the commodity, the iPhone. Once again, what you don't see in that is the relations among people involved. You don't see the blood and the bones in the money that you're handing over. You don't see the suffering of little children, women, and others in the iPhone that you're buying. But that is what is actually being exchanged underneath this exchange of commodities. All that is hidden, particularly in a parasitic society like this that feeds and feasts off so much of the rest of the world. But it's even gotten to the point where even people in this society are openly reduced to commodities. I mentioned this earlier. Develop your brand. You hear these celebrities, I'm working on my brand, you know. I'm trying to increase the value of my brand. This is openly treating a person like a commodity. And this is being popularized in the culture. But on the other side, at the same time, we find commodities being treated like people, as if they are actually conscious beings. Think about it. How many times have we heard things like this? The market doesn't like this. Or the market is very happy about that. Give me a break. The market is not a person. It is a social relation, a relation of exploitation, a relation where many are exploited by a relative few. Think back to the slave market that I referred to earlier. There is the market. It's openly trading in human beings. Sexual slavery and even pornography are openly trading in human flesh. Human beings are being bought and sold and exploited over and over by those who buy them. But at the same time, and on an even bigger scale, under this system, huge numbers of people who are not literally slaves are still being brutally exploited in crushing conditions of poverty all over the world. And this is what is being speculated on in the market. What are people speculating on in the market? They're betting on how profitable or not this or that company will be relative to another one, or this or that commodity. And where does the profit come from? The more intense exploitation of real human beings, in effect and in reality, what the market involves is speculating on misery. In keeping with the nature and needs of this system, there is, along with all this, the deliberate promotion of mindless self-seeking individualism and mind-numbing pursuits. There is the spreading of notions of ownership and empowerment within a system that is not only marked by deep inequalities, but which literally grinds up masses of human beings in its machinery of exploitation, backing all this up with mass slaughter and destruction. There is, for some, the building of penthouses and mansions, or in any case, pursuing a life of privilege and luxury, literally on a foundation of human bones, of people weighed down and driven down, battered, broken, and blown apart all over the world. There is the continual promotion of pursuing dreams of personal fulfillment and chasing endless gratification while remaining ignorant of and oblivious to the suffering on which all this rests, a continent or perhaps just a mile away. I think of the ad I saw a few years ago, this guy sitting in his recliner drinking his beer. On comes the ad from one of these big box appliance companies telling him that he needs this and he needs that and the one he has now is old and he needs to get a new one and so forth. And it goes on and on, and finally the crowning climax of this ad is the guy manages to get his fat ass a little bit farther up in the chair and he cries out, "I want it all and I want it now." And this is sort of a perfect metaphor for the kind of culture that's promoted in this system. And we can't ignore the way this even gets parroted among the oppressed themselves. I saw that Public Enemy is coming out with a new CD that they're bypassing the whole industry and going directly onto the internet, and hopefully this will be something good we'll need to see. But probably one of the main reasons they're bypassing the industry is what gets promoted in the industry, what gets supported and promoted. In hip-hop, for example, misogyny, crude demeaning and degrading of women, openly promoting the idea of getting yours on the back or through the blood of other people. Get rich or die trying, I gotta get mine no matter what I gotta do. And often all wrapped up with religious obscurantism and crosses and references to nonsense in a poisonous package. And what do we hear? What's the excuse when people are confronted with this? Oh, I'm just keeping it real. I'm just telling it the way it really is down here. Keeping it real, my ass. You are helping to keep it going the way it is. And then there's Beyonce Knowles, or as I think she should be called, Beyonce Don't Knowles. You know, after Osama bin Laden was killed, she picked up this song from this old country clown, Lee Greenwood, God Bless the USA. I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And she put out her version of this song on the heels of the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Come on. What we see here is these bourgeois strata seeking their interests in a way tied in with the horrors of this system and the masses of people suffering terrible oppression under this system. Instead of this, all this garbage, we need more fight the power. Instead of the promotion of getting in on the oppression, we need the promotion of fighting to put an end to it. Think about what's going on in the popular culture, particularly in hip-hop, the promotion of pimping, the brutal treatment of women, tricked and forced into this and maintaining it through the most disgusting violence, even turning it into adjectives, pimpalicious and all the rest. Think about it, the effect this has on the youth coming up and on the culture and the people broadly. Because a big part of all this is what we could call guy culture. It's a culture of degrading domination of women and of wanton violence, a kind of pornography of violence, with an American chauvinist and male chauvinist thrust to it. Think about some of these video games where the point is you go out and you kill America's enemies. That's the point of the video game as identified by the army and the ruling class as a whole. Or the video games where a lot of youth are trained and conditioned to think while they're playing the game. They think they're just going like using their thumbs and fingers. They're using their brains though. Their brains are being influenced. You have video games not only to go out and kill America's enemies, you have video games where the high point is you get to hunt down and kill a woman who's portrayed as a whore. How does this condition young people, boys in particular, to think about women and the relations between genders? Think about one of the main institutions and sites of male bonding in this society. Along with pornography, the strip club. That's where you go to hang out with and bond with other young guys or other older guys. Participating in and being titillated by the degradation of women forced to do this. What kind of thinking and conditioning is going on here in terms of how people who are being socialized in this way are being influenced to think about women and whether they're human beings and about the relations and what sex should be about? Look, let's face it. Sex, if it's done right, among people who really care about each other and on the basis of equality and what they want, let's face it, it's one of the greatest pleasures human beings can have, okay? but not when it's done by one part degrading the other part. And this is what people are being socialized to think of as the norm and as the object, the goal. And then we have the phrase, man up. Think about this. What is the logic of this phrase? What is the meaning of man up? It means you stand up and be strong and don't be a coward and don't back down from your responsibilities or from danger. And these are presented as attributes, qualities of men. Now, by logic, who does not have these qualities? Who are these qualities not of? Obviously, women. Think if you went out there and said, look, quit being so weak, woman up. It wouldn't make any sense in the dominant culture. It could make a lot of sense in reality, but it wouldn't make any sense in the dominant culture. Once again, people are being conditioned that to stand up for principle, to stand up for right, to not be afraid or shrink in the face of danger or sacrifice, or taking responsibility, are qualities of men that men should exercise. And it becomes so perverse that not only do you hear women being influenced to use this phrase, but you see it being promoted in the culture that if a woman wants to have these qualities, then somehow she has to try to man up. I think of the movie G.I. Jane with Demi Moore. This is a movie portraying the great advance for the cause of liberation of women as a woman who can make it in the tough confines and environs of the U.S. military, become part of the machinery of oppressing and slaughtering human beings all over the world. And the storyline of this movie is Demi Moore plays this woman who has to fight through every attempt of her drill instructor in the basic training and the rest to drive her out of the military. And one after another, she passes these tests and she finds it hard and she needs to get support and advice, but she perseveres. And finally, it comes down to the crowning scene, so to speak, where once again, the drill instructor is being extra hard on her, partly, it seems, to drive her out, but maybe to make her actually rise up to the challenge. And in this scene, he's just driving her and driving her and driving her, test after test, and he keeps saying to her, you want to quit? You want to quit? You want to quit? And finally, she turns and says, no, you, suck my, which, of course, she does not have. But what is the point? The point is that in order to be really tough and worthy, you have to man up even if you're a woman. Or what about the phrase that's out there so much too, being made into somebody's bitch? That's the lowliest thing you could be. A woman, and in particular a woman who's portrayed as being somewhat hysterical and frenzied, like a dog in heat. Being made into somebody's bitch, that's the lowest thing. And you see it even translated into all kinds of ways. For example, you go out on the basketball court. Somebody takes a shot. It doesn't go right in. It bounces on the rim. It's rolling around. And they'll say, get in there, bitch. Now think about it. Why are they saying, get in there, bitch? Because the basketball is acting like a recalcitrant woman. It's not doing what it's supposed to do according to the dictates of this man. It's supposed to get in the basket. And it's rolling around instead, and it might fall out. Get in there, bitch! How is that conditioning people to think even without their being fully conscious of it? Imagine if some white guy went out on the court, started playing basketball, took a shot, and was rolling around the rim. He said, get in there, nigger! Well, this is the same thing. And once again, you can get away with this in this culture now. It's acceptable. It's conditioning people. And along with this, the women under this system are conditioned even girls from an early age, to internalize and to go along with so much of this, or to accept that this is the way things are and that nothing better can be expected from men, so try to own it. Market yourself and get the most you can out of this while remaining in what is, in fact, an oppressed and degraded position. Now, all this is not hardwired in people. It's not hardwired in guys any more than in the young women. It's ways that guys are conditioned by the dominant institutions and media and culture to think and act, reflecting the basic oppressive relations of this system and serving the interests of its ruling class. So developing a radical revolt against this revolting culture in many different forms and on many different levels is a very important part of and can make a very important contribution to fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. Even if much of this culture that becomes part of this radical revolt is not all the way revolutionary and doesn't completely express the communist point of view, it can still make a big contribution. By raising disgust at the putrid culture that dominates, by inspiring and provoking people to think differently and think critically, to question what they would otherwise accept, to ponder why the world is the way it is, to dream about and argue about the possibility of a radically different world, to come alive with righteous outrage and the joy of calling out and rebelling against what should not be tolerated. And this contribution will be all the greater if people who do have a communist understanding bring forward a vibrant culture that expresses that and inspires people toward that while relating in a good way to the many and diverse expressions of a culture of radical revolt against this truly revolting culture.
All right, that was Resisting the Brainwash, A Radical Revolt Against a Revolting Culture, an excerpt from a talk by Bob Avakian called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And you can find this DVD on the special feature page of the Upsurge Against Sexual Assault at revcom.us. And the entire film is available at revolutiontalk.net. Once again, that's revolutiontalk.net, and the DVD is BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. That brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank all of my guests today, Cora McSherry of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, artist Dred Scott, and I also want to thank the people who worked on the show, assistant producer Henry Carson, production assistant Jeff Pryor, and engineer Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in, and if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out with the Thievery Corporation and sound the alarm. And we really do need to start doing something about sounding the alarm, all right? So talk to you again next week.